Okay, try Debbie, Jerome says. Both the IE one and the one that ends with an I. Holly brushes a clump of mouse brown hair out of her eyes so he can see her annoyance clearly.
Find something to do, Jerome, okay? I don't want you looking over my shoulder, I hate that.
She shifts her attention to Hodges.
Can I smoke in here? I hope I can. It helps me think. Cigarettes help me think.
Hodges gets her a saucer. Smoking lamps lit. Jerome and I will be in my study. Give a holler if you find something. Small chance of that, he thinks. Small chance of anything, really. Holly pays no attention. She's lighting up. She's left the revival preacher voice behind and returned to mumbling.
Hope she left a hint. I have hint hope. Hint hope is what Holly has.
Oh boy, Hodges thinks. In the study, he asks Jerome if he has any idea what kind of hint she's talking about. After three tries, some computers will give you a password hint to jog your memory in case you forget, but only if one has been programmed. From the kitchen there comes a hearty, non-mumbled cry.
Shit! Double shit! Triple shit!
Hodges and Jerome look at each other. Guess not, Jerome says. 20. Hodges turns his own computer on and tells Jerome what he wants, a list of all public gatherings for the next 7 days. I can do that, Jerome says, but you might want to check this out first. What? It's a message. Under the blue umbrella. Click it. Hodges' hands are clenched into fists, but as he reads Merce Kill's latest communique, they slowly open. The message is short, and although it's of no immediate help, it contains a ray of hope.
So long, sucker. P.S. Enjoy your weekend. I know I will.
Jerome says, I think you just got a Dear John, Bill. Hodges thinks so too, but he doesn't care. He's focused on the P.S. He knows it might be a red herring, but if it's not, they have some time. From the kitchen comes a waft of cigarette smoke and another hearty cry of, shit!
Bill, I just had a bad thought.
What's that?
The concert tonight. That boy band, round here, at the Mingo. My sister and my mother are going to be there.
Hodges considers this. Mingo Auditorium seats 4,000, but tonight's attendees will be 80% female, mommies and their preteen daughters. There will be men in attendance, but almost every one of them will be chaperoning their daughters and their daughters' friends. Brady Hartsfield is a good-looking guy of about 30, and if he tries going to that concert by himself, he'll stick out like a sore thumb. In 21st-century America, any single man at an event primarily aimed at little girls attracts notice and suspicion. Also,
enjoy your weekend. I know I will.
Do you think I should call Mom and tell her to keep the girls home? Jerome looks dismayed at the prospect.
Barb will probably never speak to me again. Plus, there's her friend Hilda and a couple of others.
From the kitchen.
Oh, you damn thing! Give it up!
Before Hodges can reply, Jerome says, on the other hand, it sure sounds like he has something planned for the weekend and this is only Thursday. Or is that just what he wants us to think? Hodges tends to think the taunt is real. Find that cyber patrol picture of Hartsfield again, would you? The one you get when you click on Meet the Experts? While Jerome does that, Hodges calls Marlo Everett in police records. Hey, Marlo. Bill Hodges again. Hi. Yeah, a lot of excitement in Lowtown. I heard about it from Pete. Half the force is down there, right? Uh-huh. Well, I won't keep you long. Do you know if Larry Windham is still head of security at the MAC? Yeah, that's right. Romper Stomper. Sure, I'll hold. While he does, he tells Jerome that Larry Windham took early retirement because the MAC offered him the job at twice the salary he was making as a detective. He doesn't say that wasn't the only reason Windham pulled the pin after 20. Then Marlo is back. Yes, Larry's still at the MAC. She even has the number of the MAC security office. Before he can say goodbye, she asks him if there's a problem.
Because there's a big concert there tonight. My niece is going. She's crazy about those twerps.
It's fine, Marlo. It's just some old business. Tell Larry we could use him today, Marlo says.
The squad room is dead empty. Nary a detective in sight.
I'll do that. Hodges calls Max Security, identifies himself as Detective Bill Hodges, and asks for Wyndham. While he waits, he stares at Brady Hartsfield. Jerome has enlarged the photo so it fills the whole screen. Hodges is fascinated by the eyes. In the smaller version, and in a line with the two IT colleagues, those eyes seemed pleasant enough. With the picture filling the screen, however, that changes. The mouth is smiling. The eyes aren't. The eyes are flat and distant. Almost dead. Bullshit, Hodges tells himself, scolds himself. This is a classic case of seeing something that's not there based on recently acquired knowledge, like a bank robbery witness saying, I thought he looked shifty even before he pulled out that gun. Sounds good. Sounds professional, but Hodges doesn't believe it. He thinks the eyes looking out of the screen are the eyes of a toad hiding under a rock, or under a cast-off blue umbrella. Then Wyndham's on the line. He has the kind of booming voice that makes you want to hold the phone 2 inches from your ear while you talk to him, and he's the same old yapper. He wants to know all about the big bust that afternoon. Hodges tells him it's a megabust all right, but beyond that he knows from nothing. He reminds Larry that he's retired. But with all that going on, he says, Pete Huntley kind of drafted me to call you, hope you don't mind.
Jesus, no, I'd like to have a drink with you, Billy, talk over old times now that we're both out. You know, hash and trash.
That would be good. Pure hell is what it would be.
How can I help?
You've got a concert there tonight, Pete says, some hot boy band, the kind all the little girls love.
Aye, 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 do they ever. They're already lining up and tuning up. Someone will shout out one of those kids' names and they all scream. Even if they're still coming in from the parking lot, they scream. It's like Beatlemania back in the day, only from what I hear, this crew ain't the Beatles. You got a bomb threat or something? Tell me you don't. The chicks will tear me apart and the mommies will eat the leftovers.
What I've got is a tip that you may have a child molester on your hands tonight. This is a bad, bad boy, Larry.
Name and description?
Hard and fast, no bullshit. The guy who left the force because he was a bit too quick with his fists. Anger issues, in the language of the department shrink. Romper stomper, in the language of his colleagues. His name is Brady Hartsfield. I'll email you his picture. Hodges glances at Jerome, who nods and makes a circle with his thumb and forefinger. He's approximately 30 years old. If you see him, call me first, then grab him. Use caution. If he tries to resist, subdue the motherfucker.
With pleasure, Billy. I'll pass this along to my guys. Any chance he'll be with a, I don't know, a beard? A teenage girl or someone even younger?
Unlikely, but not impossible. If you spot him in a crowd, Lair, you gotta take him by surprise. He could be armed.
How good are the chances he's going to be at the show?
He actually sounds hopeful, which is typical Larry Wyndham. Not very. Hodges absolutely believes this, and it's not just the blue umbrella hint Hartsfield dropped about the weekend. He has to know that in a girls' night out audience, he'd have no way of being unobtrusive. In any case, you understand why the department can't send cops, right, with all that's going on in Lowtown?
Don't need them, Wyndham says. I've got 35 guys tonight, most of the regulars retired popo. We know what we're doing.
I know you do, Hodges says. Remember, call me first. Us retired guys don't get much action, and we have to protect what we do get. Wyndham laughs.
I hear you on that. Email me the picture.
He recites an e-address, which Hodges jots down and hands to Jerome.
If we see him, we grab him. After that, it's your bust, Uncle Bill.
Fuck you, Uncle Larry, Hodges says.
He hangs up, turns to Jerome. The pic just went out to him. Jerome says.
Good. Then Hodges says something that will haunt him for the rest of his life. If Hartsfield's as clever as I think he is, he won't be anywhere near the Mingo tonight. I think your mom and sis are good to go. If he does try crashing the concert, Larry's guys will have him before he gets in the door.
Jerome smiles. Great.
See what else you can find. Concentrate on Saturday and Sunday, but don't neglect next week. Don't neglect tomorrow either, because...
Because the weekend starts on Friday, gotcha.
Jerome gets busy.
Hodges walks out to the kitchen to check on how Holly's doing. What he sees stops him cold.
Lying next to the borrowed laptop is a red wallet. Deborah Hartsfield's ID, credit cards, and receipts are scattered across the table. Holly, already on her third cigarette, is holding up a MasterCard and studying it through a haze of blue smoke. She gives him a look that's both frightened and defiant.
I'm just trying to find her diddly-dang password. Her purse was hanging over the back of her office chair, and her billfold was right there on top, so I put it in my pocket. Because sometimes people keep their passwords in their billfolds. Women especially. I didn't want her money, Mr. Hodges. I have my own money. I get an allowance.
An allowance, Hodges thinks. Oh, Holly. Her eyes are brimming with tears, and she's biting her lips again.
I'd never steal.
Okay, he says. He thinks of patting her hand and decides it might be a bad idea just now. I understand. And Jesus God, what's the BFD on top of all the shit he's pulled since that goddamn letter dropped through his mail slot lifting a dead woman's wallet as chump change? When all this comes out, as it surely will, Hodges will say he took it himself. Holly, meanwhile, is not finished.
I have my own credit card and I have money. I even have a checking account. I buy video games and apps for my iPad. I buy clothes. Also earrings, which I like. I have 56 pairs. And I buy my own cigarettes, although they're very expensive now. It might interest you to know that in New York City, a pack of cigarettes now costs $11. I try not to be a burden because I can't work, and she says I'm not, but I know I am.
Holly, stop. You need to save that stuff for your shrink if you have one.
Of course I have one.
She flashes a grim grin at the stubborn password screen of Mrs. Hartsfield's laptop.
I'm fucked up, didn't you notice?
Hodges chooses to ignore this.
I was looking for a slip of paper with a password on it, she says, but there wasn't one. So I tried her social security number first forwards and then backwards. Same deal with her credit cards. I even tried the credit card security codes.
Any other ideas?
A couple. Leave me alone.
As he leaves the room, she calls.
I'm sorry about the smoke, but it really does help me think.
21. With Holly crunching in the kitchen and Jerome doing likewise in his study, Hodges settles into the living room lazy boy staring at the blank TV. It's a bad place to be. Maybe the worst place. The logical part of his mind understands that everything which has happened is Brady Hartsfield's fault. But sitting in the lazy boy, where he spent so many vapid, TV-soaked afternoons, feeling useless and out of touch with the essential self he took for granted during his working life, logic loses its power. What creeps in to take its place is a terrifying idea. He, Kermit William Hodges, has committed the crime of shoddy police work and has aided and abetted Mr. Mercedes by so doing. They are the stars of a reality TV show called Bill and Brady Kill Some Ladies. Because when Hodges looks back, so many of the victims seem to be women. Janie, Olivia Trelawney, Janice Cray and her daughter Patricia, plus Deborah Hartsfield, who might have been poisoned instead of poisoning herself. And he thinks, I haven't even added Holly, who will likely come out of this even more grandly fucked up than she was going in if she can't find that password. Or if she does find it and there's nothing on Mom's computer that can help us to find Sonny Boy. And really, how likely is that? Sitting here in this chair, knowing he should get up but as yet unable to move, Hodges thinks his own destructive record with women stretches back even further. His ex-wife is his ex for a reason. Years of near-alcoholic drinking were part of it, but for Corrine, who liked to drink her three herself and probably still does, not the major part. It was the coldness that first stole through the cracks in the marriage and finally froze it solid. It was how he shut her out, telling himself it was for her own good because so much of what he did was nasty and depressing. How he made it clear in a dozen ways, some large, some small, that in a race between her and the job, Corrine Hodges always came in second. As for his daughter, well, geez, Hallie never misses sending him birthday and Christmas cards, although the Valentine's Day card stopped about 10 years ago. And she hardly ever misses the Saturday evening duty call, but she hasn't been to see him in a couple of years. Which really says all that needs saying about how he bitched up that relationship. His mind drifts to how beautiful she was as a kid with those freckles and that mop of red hair, his little carrot top. She'd pelt down the hall to him when he came home and jump fearlessly, knowing he'd drop whatever he was holding and catch her. Janie mentioned being crazy about the Bay City Rollers, and Allie had had her own faves, her own bubblegum boy toys. She bought their records with her own allowance, little ones with the big hole in the center. Who was on them? He can't remember, only that one of the songs went on and on about every move you make and every step you take. Was that Bananarama or the Thompson Twins? He doesn't know, but he does know he never took her to a concert, although Corey might have taken her to see Cyndi Lauper. Thinking about Allie and her love of pop music rings in a new thought, one that makes him sit up straight, eyes wide, hands clutching the Lazy Boy's padded arms. Would he have let Allie go to that concert tonight? The answer is absolutely not. No way. Hodges checks his watch and sees it's closing in on 4 o'clock. He gets up, meaning to go into the study and tell Jerome to call his moms and tell her to keep those girls away from the Mac no matter how much they piss and moan. He's called Larry Windham and taken precautions, but precautions be damned. He would never have put Allie's life in Romper Stomper's hands. Never. Before he can get 2 steps toward the study, Jerome calls out, "Bill, Holly, come here. I think I found something." 22. They stand behind Jerome. Hodges looking over his left shoulder and Holly over his right. On the screen of Hodges' computer is a press release. Synergy Corp, Citibank, 3 restaurant chains to put on Midwest's biggest summer careers day at Embassy Suites. For immediate release, career business people and military veterans are encouraged to attend the biggest careers day of the year on Saturday, June 5th, 2010. This recession-busting event will be held at the downtown Embassy Suites 1 Synergy Square. Prior registration is encouraged but not necessary. You will discover hundreds of exciting and high-paying jobs at the Citibank website, at your local McDonald's, Burger King, and Chicken Coop, or at www.synergy.com. Jobs available include customer service, retail, security, plumbing, electrical, accounting, financial analysts, telemarketing, cashiers. You will find trained and helpful job guides and useful seminars in all conference rooms. There is no charge. Doors open at 8 a.m. Bring your resume and dress for success. Remember that prior registration will speed the process and improve your chances of finding that job you've been looking for. Together, we will beat this recession. What do you think? Jerome asks. I think you nailed it. An enormous wave of relief sweeps through Hodges. Not the concert tonight, or a crowded downtown dance club, or the Groundhogs Mud Hens minor league baseball game tomorrow night. It's this thing at Embassy Suites. Gotta be. It's too perfectly rounded to be anything else. There's method in Brady Hartsfield's madness. To him, alpha equals omega. Hartsfield means to finish his career as a mass murderer the same way he started it, by killing the city's jobless. Hodges turns to see how Holly is taking this, but Holly has left the room. She's back in the kitchen, sitting in front of Deborah Hartsfield's laptop and staring at the password screen. Her shoulders are slumped. In the saucer beside her, a cigarette has smoldered down to the filter, leaving a neat roll of ash. This time he risks touching her. "It's okay, Holly. The password doesn't matter because now we've got the location. I'm going to get with my old partner in a couple of hours, when this low-town thing's had a chance to settle a bit, and tell him everything. They'll put out a bolo on Hartsfield in his car. If they don't get him before Saturday morning, they'll get him as he approaches the job fair."
"Isn't there anything we can do tonight?"
"I'm thinking about that. There is one thing, although it's such a long shot, it's practically a no-shot."
Holly says, What if you're wrong about it being the career day? What if he plans to blow up a movie theater tonight?
Jerome comes into the room. It's Thursday, Hal, and still too early for the big summer pictures. Most screens won't be playing to even a dozen people.
The concert, then, she says. Maybe he doesn't know it'll be all girls.
He'll know, Hodges says. He's a creature of improvisation, but that doesn't make him stupid. He'll have done at least some advance planning.
Can I have just a little more time to try and crack her password? Please?
Hodges glances at his watch. 4:10. Sure. Until 4:30, how's that? A bargaining glint comes into her eyes.
4:45?
Hodges shakes his head. Holly sighs.
I'm out of cigarettes, too.
Those things will kill you, Jerome says. She gives him a flat look.
Yes, that's part of their charm.
23. Hodges and Jerome drive down to the little shopping center at the intersection of Harper and Hanover to buy Holly a pack of cigarettes and give her the privacy she clearly wants. Back in the gray Mercedes, Jerome tosses the Winstons from hand to hand and says, "This car gives me the creeps."
Me too, Hodges admits. But it didn't seem to bother Holly, did it, sensitive as she is?
Do you think she'll be all right? After this is over, I mean?
A week ago, maybe even 2 days, Hodges would have said something vague and politically correct, but he and Jerome have been through a lot since then.
For a while, he says. Then, no.
Jerome sighs the way people do when their own dim view of things has been confirmed.
Fuck.
Yeah.
So what now?
Now we go back, give Holly her coffin nails, and let her smoke one. Then we pack up the stuff she filched from the Hartsfield house. I drive you two back to the Birch Hill Mall. You return Holly to Sugar Heights in your Wrangler, then go home yourself.
And just let Mom and Barb and her friends go to that show. Hodges blows out a breath.
If it'll make you feel easier, tell your mother to pull the plug.
If I do that, it all comes out. Still tossing the cigarettes back and forth. Everything we've been doing today.
Jerome is a bright boy, and Hodges doesn't need to confirm this, or remind him that eventually it's all going to come out anyway.
What will you do, Bill?
Go back to the north side, park the Mercedes a block or two away from the Hartsfield place just to be safe. I'll return Mrs. Hartsfield's laptop and billfold, then stake out the house in case he decides to come back.
Jerome looks doubtful. That basement room looked like he made a pretty clean sweep. What are the chances?
Slim and none, but it's all I've got, until I turn this thing over to Pete.
You really wanted to make the collar, didn't you?
Yes, Hodges says and sighs. Yes, I did.
24.
When they come back, Holly's head is down on the table and hidden in her arms. The deconstructed contents of Deborah Hartsfield's wallet are an asteroid belt around her. The laptop is still on and still showing the stubborn password screen. According to the clock on the wall, it's 4:40. Hodges is afraid she'll protest his plan to return her home, but Holly only sits up, opens the fresh pack of cigarettes, and slowly removes one. She's not crying, but she looks tired and dispirited.
You did your best, Jerome says.
I always do my best, Jerome, and it's never good enough.
Hodges picks up the red wallet and starts returning the credit cards to the slots. They're probably not in the same order Mrs. Hartsfield had them in, but who's going to notice? Not her.
There are photos in an accordion of transparent envelopes, and he flips through them idly. Here's Mrs. Hartsfield standing arm in arm with a broad-shouldered, burly guy in a blue work coverall. The absent Mr. Hartsfield, perhaps. Here's Mrs. Hartsfield standing with a bunch of laughing ladies in what appears to be a beauty salon. Here's one of a chubby little boy holding a fire truck. Brady, at age 3 or 4, probably. And one more. A wallet-sized version of the picture in Mrs. Hartsfield's alcove office. Brady and his mom with their cheeks pressed together. Jerome taps it and says,
"You know what that reminds me of a little? Demi Moore and what's-his-name, Ashton Kutcher."
Demi Moore has black hair, Holly says matter-of-factly. except in G.I. Jane, where she hardly had any at all because she was learning to be a SEAL. I saw that movie 3 times, once in the theater, once on videotape, and once on my iTunes. Very enjoyable. Mrs. Hartsfield is blonde-headed. She considers, then adds, was.
Hodges slides the photo out of the pocket for a better look, then turns it over. Carefully printed on the back is, Mom and Her Honey Boy, Sand Point Beach, August 2007. He flicks the picture against the side of his palm a time or two, almost puts it back, then slides it across to Holly, photo side down. Try that.
She frowns at him. Try what?
Honey Boy. Holly types it in, hits return, and utters a very un-Holly-like scream of joy. Because they're in, just like that. There's nothing of note on the desktop. An address book, a folder marked favorite recipes, and another marked saved emails. A folder of online receipts. She seemed to have paid most of her bills that way. And an album of photos, most of Brady at various ages. There are a lot of TV shows in her iTunes, but only one album of music. Alvin and the Chipmunks Celebrate Christmas. Christ, Jerome says. I don't want to say she deserved to die, but... Holly gives him a forbidding look.
Not funny, Jerome. Do not go there.
He holds up his hands. Sorry, sorry. Hodges scrolls rapidly through the saved emails and sees nothing of interest. Most appear to be from Mrs. Hartsfield's old high school buddies who refer to her as Debs. There's nothing here about Brady, he says and glances at the clock. We should go.
Not so fast,
Holly says and opens the finder. She types Brady. There are several results, many in the recipe file, some tagged as Brady favorites, but nothing of note. Try Honey Boy. Jerome suggests. She does, and gets one result. A document buried deep in the hard drive. Holly clicks it. Here are Brady's clothing sizes, also a list of all the Christmas and birthday presents she's bought him for the last 10 years, presumably so she won't repeat herself. She's noted his social security number. There's a scanned copy of his car registration, his car insurance card, and his birth certificate. She's listed his co-workers at both Discount Electronics and Loeb's Ice Cream Factory. Next to the name Shirley Orton is a notation that would have made Brady laugh hysterically. Wonder is she his GF? What's up with this crap? Jerome asks. He's a grown man, for God's sake. Holly smiles darkly.
What I said, she knew he wasn't right.
At the very bottom of the Honey Boy file, there's a folder marked Basement.
That's it, Holly says. Gotta be. Open it, open it, open it.
Jerome clicks basement. The document inside is less than 12 words long.
Control equals lights. Chaos, question mark, question mark. Darkness, question mark, question mark. Why don't they work for me? Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark.
They stare at the screen for some time without speaking. At last, Hodges says, I don't get it. Jerome? Jerome shakes his head. Holly, seemingly hypnotized by this message from the dead woman, speaks a single word, almost too low to hear.
Maybe.
She hesitates, chewing her lips, and says it again.
Maybe.
25. Brady arrives at the Midwest Culture and Arts Complex just before 6 p.m. Although the show isn't scheduled to start for over an hour, the vast parking lot is already 3/4 full. Long lines have formed outside the doors that open onto the lobby, and they're getting longer all the time. Little girls are screeching at the top of their lungs. Probably that means they're happy, but to Brady, they sound like ghosts in a deserted mansion. It's impossible to look at the growing crowd and not recall that April morning at City Center. Brady thinks, if I had a Humvee instead of this Jap shitbox, I could drive into them at 40 miles an hour, kill 50 or more that way, then hit the switch and blow the rest into the stratosphere. But he doesn't have a Humvee, and for a moment he's not even sure what to do next. He can't be seen while he makes his final preparations. Then, at the far end of the lot, he sees a tractor-trailer box. The cab is gone, and it's up on jacks. On the side is a Ferris wheel, and a sign reading, Round Here Support Team. It's one of the trucks he saw in the loading area during his reconnaissance. Later, after the show, the cab would be reconnected and driven around back for the loadout, but now it looks deserted. He pulls in on the far side of the box, which is at least 50 feet long, and hides the Subaru completely from the bustling parking lot. He takes his fake glasses from the glove compartment and puts them on. He gets out and does a quick walk around to assure himself the trailer box is as deserted as it looks. When he's satisfied on that score, he returns to the Subaru and works the wheelchair out of the back. It's not easy. The Honda would have been better, but he doesn't trust its unmaintained engine. He places the ass parking cushion on the wheelchair's seat and connects the wire protruding from the center of the A in parking to the wires hanging from the side pockets where there are more blocks of plastic explosive. Another wire, connected to a block of plastic in the rear pocket, dangles from a hole he has punched in the seat back. Sweating profusely, Brady begins the final unification, braiding copper cores and wrapping exposed connection points with pre-cut strips of masking tape he has stuck to the front of the oversized Round Here t-shirt he bought that morning in the drugstore. The shirt features the same Ferris wheel logo as the one on the truck. Above it are the words, Kisses on the Midway. Below, it says, I love Cam, Boyd, Steve, and Pete. After 10 minutes of work, with occasional breaks to peek around the edge of the box and make sure he still has this far edge of the parking lot to himself, a spider web of connected wires lies on the seat of the wheelchair. There's no way to wire in the explosives-stuffed Uranesta pee bag, at least not that he could figure out on short notice, but that's okay. Brady has no doubt the other stuff will set it off. Not that he'll know for sure, one way or the other. He returns to the Subaru one more time and takes out the 8x10 framed version of a picture Hodges has already seen. Frankie holding Sammy the fire truck and smiling his dopey where the fuck am I smile. Brady kisses the glass and says, I love you, Frankie. Do you love me? He pretends Frankie says yes. Do you want to help me? He pretends Frankie says yes. Brady goes back to the wheelchair and sits down on ass parking. Now the only wire showing is the master wire, dangling over the front of the wheelchair seat between his spread thighs. He connects it to Thing 2 and takes a deep breath before flicking the power switch. If the electricity from the AA batteries leaks through, even a little. But it doesn't. The yellow ready lamp goes on and that's all. Somewhere not far away, but in a different world, little girls are screaming happily. Soon many of them will be vaporized. Many more will be missing arms and legs and screaming for real. Oh well, at least they'll get to listen to some music by their favorite band before the Big Bang. Or maybe not. He's aware of what a crude and makeshift plan this is. The stupidest no-talent screenwriter in Hollywood could do better. Brady remembers the sign in the corridor leading to the auditorium. No bags, no boxes, no backpacks. He has none of those things, but all it will take to blow the deal is one sharp-eyed security guard observing a single unconcealed wire. Even if that doesn't happen, a cursory glance into the wheelchair's storage pockets will reveal the fact that it's a rolling bomb. Brady has stuck a Round Here pennant in one of those pockets, but otherwise made no effort at concealment. It doesn't faze him. He doesn't know if that makes him confident or just fatalistic and doesn't think it matters. In the end, confidence and fatalism are pretty much the same, aren't they? He got away with running those people over at City Center, and there was almost no planning involved with that either, just a mask, a hairnet, and some DNA-killing bleach. In his heart, he never really expected to escape, and in this case, his expectations are zero. In a don't-give-a-fuck world, he's about to become the ultimate don't-give-a-fucker. He slips Thing 2 beneath the oversized t-shirt. There's a slight bulge, and he can see a dim yellow glimmer from the ready lamp through the thin cotton, but both the bulge and the glimmer disappear when he places Frankie's picture in his lap. He's pretty much ready to go. His fake glasses slide down the bridge of his sweat-slippery nose. Brady pushes them back up. By craning his neck slightly, he can see himself in the Subaru's passenger side rearview mirror. Bald and bespectacled, he looks nothing like his former self. He looks sick, for one thing, pale and sweaty with dark circles under his eyes. Brady runs his hand over the top of his head, feeling smooth skin where no stubble will ever have the chance to grow out. Then he backs the wheelchair out of the slot where he has parked his car and begins to roll himself slowly across the expanse of parking lot toward the growing crowd.
26. Hodges gets snared in rush hour traffic and doesn't arrive back on the north side until shortly after 6 p.m. Jerome and Holly are still with him. They both want to see this through, regardless of the consequences, and since they seem to understand what those consequences may be, Hodges has decided he can't refuse him. Not that he has much of a choice. Holly won't divulge what she knows, or thinks she knows. Hank Beeson is out of his house and crossing the street before Hodges can bring Olivia Trelawney's Mercedes to a stop in the Hartsfield driveway. Hodges sighs and powers down the driver's side window.
"I sure would like to know what's going on," Mr. Beeson says. "Does it have anything to do with all that mess down in Lowtown?"
"Mr. Beeson," Hodges says, "I appreciate your concern, but you need to go back to your house and..."
"No, wait," Holly says. She's leaning across the center console of Olivia Trelawney's Mercedes so she can look up at Beeson's face.
"Tell me how Mr. Hartsfield sounds. I need to know how his voice sounds."
Beeson looks perplexed.
"Like anyone, I guess. Why?"
"Is it low? You know, baritone?"
"You mean like one of those fat opera singers?"
Beeson laughs.
"Hell no. What kind of question is that?"
"Not high and squeaky either?"
To Hodges, Beeson says.
"Is your partner crazy?"
"Only a little," Hodges thinks. "Just answer the question, sir."
"Not low, not high and squeaky. Regular. What's going on?"
"No accent," Holly persists. "Like, southern? Or New England? Or Brooklyn, maybe?"
"No," I said. "He sounds like anybody."
Holly sits back, apparently satisfied. Hodges says, "Go back inside, Mr. Beeson, please."
Beeson snorts but backs off. He pauses at the foot of his steps to cast a glare over his shoulder. It's one Hodges has seen many times before, the "I pay your salary, asshole" glare. Then he goes inside, slamming the door behind him to make sure they get the point. Soon he appears once more at the window with his arms folded over his chest.
"What if he calls the cop shop to ask what we're doing here?" Jerome asks from the back seat.
Hodges smiles. It's wintry, but genuine. "Good luck with that tonight. Come on."
As he leads them single file along the narrow path between the house and the garage, he checks his watch. 6:15. He thinks, how the time flies when you're having fun. They enter the kitchen. Hodges opens the basement door and reaches for the light switch.
"No," Holly says. "Leave it off."
He looks at her questioningly, but Holly has turned to Jerome.
"You have to do it. Mr. Hodges is too old, and I'm a woman."
For a moment, Jerome doesn't get it. Then he does. "Control equals lights." She nods. Her face is tense and drawn.
"It should work if your voice is anywhere close to his."
Jerome steps into the doorway, clears his throat self-consciously, and says, "Control." The basement remains dark. Hodges says, "You've got a naturally low voice, not baritone, but low. It's why you sound older than you really are when you're on the phone. See if you can raise it up a little." Jerome repeats the word, and the lights in the basement come on. Holly Gibney, whose life has not exactly been a sitcom, laughs and claps her hands.
27.
It's 6:20 when Tanya Robinson arrives at the Mac, and as she joins the line of incoming vehicles, she wishes she'd listened to the girls importuning and left for the concert an hour earlier. The lot is already 3/4 full. Guys in orange vests are flagging traffic. One of them waves her to the left. She turns that way, driving with slow care because she's borrowed Jenny Carver's Tahoe for tonight's safari, and the last thing she wants is to get into a fender bender. In the seats behind her, the girls, Hilda Carver, Betsy DeWitt, Dinah Scott, and her own Barbara, are literally bouncing with excitement. They have loaded the Tahoe CD changer with their Round Here CDs. Among them, they have all six, and they squeal, "Oh, I love this one," every time a new tune comes on. It's noisy, and it's stressful, and Tanya is surprised to find she's enjoying herself quite a lot. "Watch out for the crippled guy, Mrs. Robinson," Betsy says, pointing. The crippled guy is skinny, pale, and bald, all but floating inside his baggy T-shirt. He's holding what looks like a framed picture in his lap, and she can also see one of those urine bags. A sadly jaunty Round Here pennant juts from a pocket on the side of his wheelchair. Poor man, Tanya thinks. "Maybe we should help him," Barbara says. "He's going awful slow." "Bless your kind heart," Tanya says. "Let me get us parked, and if he hasn't made it to the building when we walk back, we'll do just that." She slides the borrowed Tahoe into an empty space and turns it off with a sigh of relief. "Boy, look at the lines," Dinah says. "There must be a zillion people here." "Nowhere near that many," Tanya says. "But it is a lot. They'll open the doors soon, though. And we've got good seats, so don't worry about that."
"You still got the tickets, right, Mom?"
Tanya ostentatiously checks her purse. "Got them right here, hon."
"And we can have souvenirs?"
"One each, and nothing that costs over $10.
"I've got my own money, Mrs. Robinson," Betsy says as they climb out of the Tahoe.
The girls are a little nervous at the sight of the crowd growing outside the Mac. They cluster together, their four shadows becoming a single dark puddle in the strong early evening sunlight.
"I'm sure you do, Bets, but this is on me," Tanya says.
"Now listen up, girls. I want you to give me your money and phones for safekeeping. Sometimes there are pickpockets at these big public gatherings. I'll give everything back when we're safe in our seats, but no texting or calling once the show starts. Are we clear on that?"
"Can we each take a picture first, Mrs. Robinson?" Hilda asks.
"Yes, one each."
"Two," Barbara begs.
"All right, two, but hurry up." They each take two pictures, promising to email them later so everyone has a complete set. Tanya takes a couple of her own, with the four girls grouped together and their arms around each other's shoulders. She thinks they look lovely.
"Okay, ladies, hand over the cash and the cackle boxes."
The girls give up $30 or so among them and their candy-colored phones.
Tanya puts everything in her purse and locks Jenny Carver's van with the button on the key fob.
She hears the satisfying thump of the locks engaging, a sound that means safety and security. "Now listen, you crazy females. We're all going to hold hands until we're in our seats, okay? Let me hear you're okay."
"Okay," the girls shout and grab hands.
They're tricked out in their best skinny jeans and their best sneakers. All are wearing Round Here tees, and Hilda's ponytail has been tied with a white silk ribbon that says, "I love Cam," in red letters.
"And we're going to have fun, right? Best time ever, right? Let me hear you're okay."
"Okay!"
Satisfied, Tanya leads them toward the Mac. It's a long walk across hot macadam, but none of them seems to mind. Tanya looks for the bald man in the wheelchair and spies him making his way toward the back of the handicapped line. That one is much shorter, but it still makes her sad to see all those broken folks. Then the wheelchairs start to move. They're letting the handicapped people in first, and she thinks that's a good idea. Let all, or at least most of them, get settled in their own section before the stampede begins. As Tanya's party reaches the end of the shortest line of abled people, which is still very long, she watches the skinny bald guy propel himself up the handicap ramp and thinks how much easier it would be for him if he had one of those motorized chairs. She wonders about the picture in his lap. Some loved relative who's gone on? That seems the most likely. Poor man, she thinks again, and sends up a brief prayer to God, thanking him that her own two kids are all right.
"Mom?" Barbara says.
"Yes, honey?"
"Best time ever, right?"
Tanya Robinson squeezes her daughter's hand.
"You bet."
A girl starts singing Kisses on the Midway in a clear, sweet voice. "The sun, baby, the sun shines when you look at me. The moon, baby, the moon glows when you're next to me." More girls join in.
"Your love, your touch, just a little is never enough. I want to love you my way."
Soon the song is floating up into the warm evening air, a thousand voices strong. Tanya is happy to add her voice, and after the CD-a-thon coming from Barbara's room these last 2 weeks, she knows all the words. Impulsively, she bends down and kisses the top of her daughter's head. Best time ever, she thinks. 28. Hodges and his junior Watsons stand in Brady's basement control room looking at the row of silent computers. Chaos first, Jerome says. Then darkness, right? Hodges thinks. It sounds like something out of the Book of Revelations.
I think so, Holly says. At least that's the order she had them in.
To Hodges, she says.
She was listening, see? I bet she was listening a lot more than he knew she was listening.
She turns back to Jerome.
One thing, very important. Don't waste time if you get chaos to turn them on.
Right. The suicide program. Only what if I get nervous and my voice goes all high and squeaky like Mickey Mouse? She starts to reply, then sees the look in his eye.
Hearty har har.
But she smiles in spite of herself.
Go on, Jerome. Be Brady Hartsfield.
He only has to say chaos once. The computers flash on, and the numbers start descending. Darkness! The numbers continue to count down.
Don't shout, Holly says. Jeez! 16, 15, 14.
Darkness. I think you're too low again, Hodges says, trying not to sound as nervous as he feels.
12, 11.
Jerome wipes his mouth.
Darkness.
Mush mouth, Holly observes, perhaps not helpfully.
8, 7, 6.
Darkness.
5.
The countdown disappears. Jerome lets out a gusty sigh of relief. What replaces the numbers is a series of color photographs of men in old-timey Western clothes shooting and being shot. One has been frozen as he and his horse crash through a plate glass window.
What kind of screensavers are those?
Jerome asks. Hodges points at Brady's number 5. That's William Holden, so I guess they must be scenes from a movie.
The Wild Bunch,
Holly says.
Directed by Sam Peckinpah. I only watched it once. It gave me nightmares.
Scenes from a movie, Hodges thinks, looking at the grimaces and gunfire. Also scenes from inside Brady Hartsfield's head. Now what? Jerome says.
Holly, you start at the first one, I'll start at the last one. We'll meet in the middle. Sounds like a plan, Holly says. Mr. Hodges, can I smoke in here?
Why the hell not, he says, and goes over to the cellar stairs to sit and watch them work. As he does, he rubs absently at the hollow just below his left collarbone. That annoying pain is back. He must have pulled a muscle running down the street after his car exploded.
29.
The air conditioning in the Max lobby strikes Brady like a slap, causing his sweaty neck and arms to break out in goose flesh. The main part of the corridor is empty, because they haven't let in the regular concertgoers yet, but the right side, where there are velvet ropes and a sign reading Handicapped Access, is lined with wheelchairs that are moving slowly toward the checkpoint and the auditorium beyond. Brady doesn't like how this is playing out. He had assumed that everyone would smoosh in at the same time as they had at the Cleveland Indians game he'd gone to when he was 18, and the security guys would be overwhelmed just giving everyone a cursory look and then passing them on. The concert staff letting in the Crips and Goonie Birds first is something he should have foreseen but didn't. There are at least a dozen men and women in blue uniforms with brown patches on their shoulders reading MAC Security, and for the time being they have nothing to do but check out the handicapped folks rolling slowly past them. Brady notes with growing coldness that although they're not checking the storage pockets on all the wheelchairs, they are indeed checking the pockets on some of them, every third or fourth, and sometimes two in a row. When the Crips clear security, ushers dressed in round-ear t-shirts are directing them toward the auditorium's handicapped section. He always knew he might be stopped at the security checkpoint, but had believed he could still take plenty of round-here's young fans with him if that happened. Another bad assumption. Flying glass might kill a few of those closest to the doors, but their bodies would also serve as a blast shield. Shit, he thinks. Still, I only got 8 at City Center. I'm bound to do better than that. He rolls forward, the picture of Frankie in his lap. The edge of the frame rests against the toggle switch.
The minute one of those security goons bends to look into the pockets on the sides of the wheelchair, Brady will press a hand down on the picture, the yellow lamp will turn green, and electricity will flow to the lead azide detonators nestled in the homemade explosive. There are only a dozen wheelchairs ahead of him. Chilled air blows down on his hot skin. He thinks of City Center and how the Trelawney bitch's heavy car jounced and rocked as it ran over the people after he hit them and knocked them down, as if it were having an orgasm. He remembers the rubbery air inside the mask and how he screamed with delight and triumph. Screamed until he was so hoarse he could hardly speak at all and had to tell his mother and Tones Frobisher at DE that he had come down with laryngitis. Now there's just 10 wheelchairs between him and the checkpoint. One of the guards, probably the head honcho since he's the oldest and the only one wearing a hat, takes a backpack from a young girl who's as bald as Brady himself. He explains something to her and gives her a claim check. "They're going to catch me," Brady thinks coldly. "They are, so get ready to die." He is ready. Has been for some time now. 8 wheelchairs between him and the checkpoint. 7. 6. It's like the countdown on his computers. Then the singing starts outside, muffled at first. "The sun, baby, the sun shines when you look at me. The moon, baby." When they hit the chorus, the sound swells to that of a cathedral choir, girls singing at the top of their lungs. "I want to love you my way. We'll drive the beachside highway." At that moment, the main doors swing open. Some girls cheer, most continue singing and louder than ever. "It's gonna be a new day. I'll give you kisses on the midway." Chicks wearing round hair tops and their first makeup pour in, their parents, mostly mommies, struggling to keep up and stay connected to their brats. The velvet rope between the main part of the corridor and the handicapped zone is knocked over and trampled underfoot. A beefy 12 or 13-year-old with an ass the size of Iowa is shoved into the wheelchair ahead of Brady's, and the girl inside it who has a cheerfully pretty face and sticks for legs is almost knocked over. "Hey, watch it!" the wheelchair girl's mother shouts, but the fat bitch in the double-wide jeans is already gone, waving a round-hair pennant in one hand and her ticket in the other. Someone thumps into Brady's chair. The picture shifts in his lap, and for one cold second he thinks they're all going to go up in a white flash in a hail of steel bearings. When they don't, he raises the picture enough to peer underneath and sees the ready lamp is still glowing yellow. "Close one," Brady thinks, and grins. It's happy confusion in the hallway, and all but one of the security guards who were checking the handicapped concert-goers move to do what they can with this new influx of crazed, singing teens and preteens. The one guard who remains on the handicapped side of the corridor is a young woman, and she's waving the wheelchairs through with barely a glance. As Brady approaches her, he spots the guy in charge, Hat Honcho, standing on the far side of the corridor almost directly opposite. At 6'3" or so, he's easy to see because he towers over the girls and his eyes never stop moving. In one hand, he holds a piece of paper, which he glances down at every now and again. "Show me your tickets and go," the security woman says to the pretty wheelchair girl and her mother. "Right-hand door." Brady sees something interesting. The tall security guy in the hat grabs a guy of 20 or so who looks to be on his own and pulls him out of the scrum. "Next," the security woman calls to him. "Don't hold up the line." Brady rolls forward, ready to push Frankie's picture against the toggle switch on thing two if she shows even a passing interest in the pockets of his wheelchair. The corridor is now wall-to-wall with pushing, singing girls, and his score will be a lot higher than 30. If the corridor has to do that, we'll be fine. The security woman points at the picture. "Who's that, hun?" "My little boy," Brady says with a game smile. "He was killed in an accident last year. The same one that left me." He indicates the chair. "He loved round here, but he never got to hear their new album. Now he will." She's harried, but not too harried for sympathy. Her eyes soften. "I'm so sorry for your loss." "Thank you, ma'am," Brady says, thinking, "You stupid cunt." "Go straight ahead, sir, then bear to the right. You'll find the two handicapped aisles halfway down the auditorium. Great views. If you need help getting down the ramp, it's pretty steep. Look for one of the ushers wearing the yellow armbands."
I'll be okay, Brady says, smiling at her. Great breaks on this baby.
Good for you. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, ma'am, I sure will. Frankie will, too. Brady rolls toward the main entrance. Back at the security checkpoint, Larry Windham, known to his police colleagues as Romper Stomper, releases the young man who decided on the spur of the moment to use his kid sister's ticket when she came down with mono. He looks nothing like the creep in the photo Bill Hodges sent him. The auditorium features stadium seating, which delights Brady. The bowl shape will concentrate the explosion. He can imagine the packets of ball bearings taped under his seat fanning out. If he's lucky, he thinks, he'll get the band as well as half the audience. Pop music plays from the overhead speakers, but the girls who are filling the seats and choking the aisles drown it out with their own young and fervent voices. Spotlights swing back and forth over the crowd. Frisbees fly. A couple of oversized beach balls bounce around. The only thing that surprises Brady is that there's no sign of the Ferris wheel and all that midway shit on stage. Why did they haul it all in if they weren't going to use it? An usher with a yellow armband has just finished placing the pretty girl with the stick legs and comes up to assist Brady, but Brady waves him off. The usher gives him a grin and a pat on the shoulder as he goes by to help someone else. Brady rolls down to the first of the two sections reserved for the handicapped. He parks next to the pretty girl with the stick legs. She turns to him with a smile. Isn't this exciting? Brady smiles back, thinking, you don't know the half of it, you crippled bitch.
30. Tanya Robinson is looking at the stage and thinking of the first concert she ever went to. It was the Temps, and how Bobby Wilson kissed her right in the middle of My Girl. Very romantic. She's roused from these thoughts by her daughter, who's shaking her arm.
Look, Mom, there's the crippled man, over there with the other wheelchair people.
Barbara points to the left and down a couple of rows. Here the seats have been removed to make room for two ranks of wheelchairs.
I see him, Barb, but it's not polite to stare.
I hope he has a good time, don't you?
Tanya smiles at her daughter.
I sure do, honey.
Can we have our phones back? We need them for the start of the show.
To take pictures with is what Tanya Robinson assumes, because it's been a long time since she's been to a rock show. She opens her purse and doles out the candy-colored phones. For a wonder, the girls just hold them. For the time being, they're too busy goggling around to call or text. Tanya puts a quick kiss on top of Barb's head and then sits back, lost in the past, thinking of Bobby Wilson's kiss. Not quite the first, but the first good one. She hopes that when the time comes, Barb will be as lucky.
31.
Oh, my happy clapping Jesus, Holly says and hits her forehead with the heel of her hand. She's finished with Brady's number one, nothing much there, and has moved on to number two.
Jerome looks up from number five, which seems to have been exclusively dedicated to video games, most of the Grand Theft Auto and Call of Duty sort. What?
It's just that every now and then I run across someone even more screwed in the head than me, she says. It cheers me up. That's terrible, I know it is, but I can't help it.
Hodges gets up from the stairs with a grunt and comes over to look. The screen is filled with small photos. They appear to be harmless cheesecake, not much different from the kind he and his friends used to moon over in Adam and Spicy Leg Art back in the late 50s. Holly enlarges three of them and arranges them in a row. Here is Deborah Hartsfield wearing a filmy robe, and Deborah Hartsfield wearing baby doll pajamas, and Deborah Hartsfield in a frilly pink bra and panty set.
My God, it's his mother, Jerome says. His face is a study in revulsion, amazement, and fascination. And it looks like she posed.
It looks that way to Hodges, too.
Yup, Holly says. Paging Dr. Freud. Why do you keep rubbing your shoulder, Mr. Hodges?
Pulled a muscle, he says, but he's starting to wonder about that.
Jerome glances at the desktop screen of number three, starts to check out the photos of Brady Hartsfield's mother again, then does a double take.
Whoa, he says. Look at this, Bill.
Sitting in the lower left-hand corner of number three's desktop is a blue umbrella icon.
Open it, Hodges says.
He does, but the file is empty. There's nothing unsent, and as they now know, all old correspondence on Debbie's blue umbrella goes straight to Data Heaven. Jerome sits down at number 3.
This must be his go-to glow box, Hals. Almost got to be.
She joins him.
I think the other ones are mostly for show, so he can pretend he's on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise or something.
Hodges points to a file.